From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Baltimore City has lost 10,000 people or more since 2015. Meanwhile, the state's population is growing. Why are people leaving the city, and what can be done to stop the drain? We talked to sociologist Carl Alexander about how adapting schools to parents' goals might keep middle-class families in the city. And Professor Seema Iyer, head of the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, tells what neighbors can do to hold on to their communities.
Make sure your schools don't close. You want to make sure that you get a grocery store in your neighborhood. You want to make sure that you don't have vacant and abandoned property. The root cause of all of those things is making sure people continuously want to move into your neighborhood.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. You don't need data to know that Baltimore once had a lot more residents. The city's many vacant buildings tell the story. The population is less than two-thirds of its peak in the 1950s. And now the city appears to be shrinking even further. The U.S. Census Bureau recently estimated that Baltimore City lost more than 5,300 people between July 2016 and July 2017. That follows an estimated loss of 6,000 people the previous year. Meanwhile, the state's population is growing. Why are people leaving the city? Who is leaving? And what can the city and its residents do to stop the hemorrhaging? In a bit, we'll talk to a Johns Hopkins sociologist who's focusing on schools in an effort to keep middle-class families in the city. But first, University of Baltimore professor Seema Iyer joins us. She heads the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, which is part of the Jacob France Institute in the university's Merrick School of Business. The Indicators Alliance gathers data on the city at the neighborhood level, painting a much more detailed picture than the U.S. Census, and it has just released a new report. Seema Iyer, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do you think of these latest census estimates on the city's population? Should we be concerned?
I think we should be concerned that we possibly are not growing. I don't know if I necessarily believe the actual numbers. They seem much, much larger than any of our other numbers would estimate. But, you know, 2 years in a row for them to say that we actually had a loss, I think that is pointing to something.
And do we know who is leaving the city?
We've dug into some of the data around the 35 to 50-year-old crowd seems to be the ones that we're losing the most. And those tend to be the folks that are forming a household, you know, having children. But that's kind of the sense that we get so far.
How do you get that sense?
The estimates don't give us, you know, exact breakdowns of, you know, literally who's moving. They don't do it by race. They do it by age a little bit. And then we look at the kind of households that might be moving. So in some cases, we might be losing large households, but in their place become a smaller household. You know, a household of four might get replaced in that housing unit with two. So we technically got a loss, but that housing unit actually remains to be occupied. So that's why some of our other indicators are not showing such a dramatic decline in population. But it could be a combination of a smaller household size moving in, and you know, and that age range is typically what, you know, might be that moment when people might be moving out.
Are there groups in the city that are growing despite the overall decline?
Absolutely. Millennials are growing. Everybody under 35, we continue to see people moving into the city. You know, moving into the city happens in actually very happy moments in your life. You know, I got into college, I'm moving to Baltimore. I got a job, I'm moving to Baltimore. And I formed a household, you know, whatever kind of unit, either through marriage or through some other partnership, that you moved to Baltimore. And we actually see those happy moments when people move into Baltimore.
So then does it follow that it's always bad news in somebody's personal life when they leave?
It's something about the moment in their life when they have to make a decision on whether to stay or whether to leave. Sometimes it's you found a new job and, you know, the job is far away and so you end up moving. Or, you know, you have a child and you're debating on which school you want to send the child to. And if you can't find what you're looking for in the city, you might choose to move outside to the region. We've also seen a little bit of when people retire. They might have been living and working in Baltimore City their whole life. And at the moment of retiring, when they're going to not necessarily, you know, become lower income, but they're going to a fixed income, whatever that income might be. And we have heard people choosing to leave the city at that moment, which I think is almost a real tragedy because they've just spent all their kind of social capital in the city of Baltimore. We'd love to figure out ways to keep them here.
The Alliance tracks more than 150 indicators in each neighborhood, ranging from life expectancy to reports of clogged storm drains. But the new report notes that the total population of a neighborhood is the most important piece of data. Why?
Right. So when we think about, oh, the city might be losing population, we clearly have neighborhoods that are bursting at the seams and growing like gangbusters. So how can this kind of irony exist in our city? And that's why it ends up being that every neighborhood is essentially competing with every other neighborhood, not only in the city, but in the region, to try and attract potential, you know, either, you know, potential homeowners or potential renters into their neighborhood. And so all of our neighborhoods are looking for ways to improve their quality of life. And if you think about it, we're a city that was already built out by 1950. All of our neighborhoods have the infrastructure for way more people than are here right now. And so the question is, what can your neighborhood do to retain the people that are there? Keep attracting people to your neighborhood, because every neighborhood is going to lose somebody, right? Neighborhoods flow with in and out of people. And so if somebody moves because, you know, they get a new job or they do choose to move to the county or, you know, they unfortunately pass away, is there a market that's going to want to choose your neighborhood over all the other 280 neighborhoods that are in the city and the who knows how many neighborhoods in the region? And so what is your neighborhood capable of doing right now to make sure that your neighborhood has a flow of people that are looking at it all the time for whenever they might choose, and to make sure that your neighborhood has all the features that people might be looking for?
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with University of Baltimore professor Seema Iyer. She studies the city's neighborhoods. Inequality between neighborhoods also stems from population decline. Explain that.
Right. So if you think about why population change is such an important indicator for us, it really drives a lot of the other issues that neighborhoods face, and they become compounded with one another. So, for example, a neighborhood that's growing too fast, you know, population change is really high. What are you going to hear about in those neighborhoods? You're going to hear about congestion. You're going to hear about rising home prices and people feeling that they might be getting displaced from the neighborhood that they might have been there for a long time. You're going to hear about actually rise in crime, because what happens when population growth occurs? Retailers come in too. And retailers, there's just more to steal, right? There's more potential for property crimes. In a declining neighborhood, you know, the number one indicator is vacant and abandoned property. Mm-hmm. And everything that potentially can ensue after that. Illicit behavior, you know, people that can't get out of these neighborhoods because they can't sell their property because there's nobody moving in. It becomes a vicious cycle when you have population loss, including things like school enrollment goes down because you're losing population. Food deserts can occur because you lose retail, and food is part of retail establishment. And so if you want to make sure your schools don't close, you want to make sure that you get a grocery store in your neighborhood. You want to make sure that, you know, you don't have vacant and abandoned property. The root cause of all of those things is making sure people continuously want to move into your neighborhood. And what I think the message to neighborhoods is that this is a much more empowering message than waiting for something to come from, you know, the state or the feds or even kind of the city government. What can our neighborhoods do right now? Low cost, high impact ways that they can continue to market their neighborhoods. Who do they want to move into their neighborhood, right? Maybe their cousin Joe, they want to try and market the neighborhood next door when it goes to sale, or a coworker that they want to, you know, suggest that they move into their neighborhood. Really be more proactive about thinking about who could potentially move into your city and what, or into your neighborhood, and what could we be doing on a daily basis with your community-based organizations?
Well, let me press you for more answers to that. What else can neighborhoods do?
So really look at why either homes are selling or are not selling in your neighborhood. Get to know the real estate agents in your neighborhood. They're trying to sell your properties in your neighborhood every day. And ask them, have a tea, bring them in for tea every month or something like that. And ask them, what are they hearing when people look at properties in your neighborhood? Are they saying, what kinds of things are they hearing people say that they either will choose your neighborhood or wouldn't choose your neighborhood? And in the case where they wouldn't choose your neighborhood, are there things that you can advocate for to make sure that they're there for the next time that person might come to look at your neighborhood? And of course, we have lots of structural problems. But every neighborhood has a little bit. What our data shows is that not every neighborhood is experiencing every kind of problem, right? Different neighborhoods experience different things that become priorities for them. And that's the kind of thing that understanding why people are or are not moving into your neighborhood helps you identify how to prioritize.
Well, maybe I'm leaping to a conclusion, but part of what I'm hearing you say is that some neighborhoods are growing even as the city shrinks. So are there lessons in those growing neighborhoods? Do they tend to be lessons that other neighborhoods could learn, or the neighborhoods that are losing residents, it's like, well, yes, we'd love to have those amenities, but we don't have them, so of course we're losing.
It's a combination of both of those things. So if you look at the neighborhoods that grew, we actually did an analysis that's available on our website. If you look at the neighborhoods that grew, every single neighborhood in the city of Baltimore that is growing today is along some major corridor that enters into the city, somewhere along I-83, somewhere along I-95, somewhere along 295, any one of our highways where people can get in and out of the city very quickly. And this includes pretty much everything around the water, everything up and down, north Baltimore and south Baltimore, like Brooklyn Curtis Bay, is growing. And so if we think about, not every neighborhood is going to get a highway, but really thinking about our transit and transportation system, which is a big nut to crack. But for our neighborhoods that have a, inaccessible, that's one of our key things that we found that neighborhoods have to deal with. The other one is, of course, vacant and abandoned property. We found that, a neighborhood that has excessive vacant and abandoned property just is the one thing that doesn't allow other people to move in and becomes a very vicious cycle. Once nobody moves in, you're going to get more and more vacant and abandoned property.
So even if there are good properties that could be lived in that are in okay shape, if they're near vacants,
they won't get filled up because people are looking at the vacants saying, oh, I'm never going to get equity in my property if I, buy or something like that. So we really do have neighborhoods that are at the cusp of kind of increasing rates of vacancy, very low right now, may seem low right now, but to really focus in on them and make sure that you address those vacant properties in your neighborhood right now. We have neighborhoods that unfortunately are way beyond, 10, 20% vacancy, which requires lots of advocates, including all of us that do this kind of work to make sure that we address this as a city. And of course, the city does have things. We did find, for example, in this report, the very first time that we've been tracking this data around vacancy, Sandtown Winchester posted a decline in vacant and abandoned housing rate for the first time since we've been tracking. So that's, a sign of good news that we're tackling kind of big structural issues.
Baltimore has been in the national news a lot the last few years. The unrest after the death of Freddie Gray, the Department of Justice investigation into police misconduct, the revelations about the police department's gun trace task force. Just yesterday, the new police chief resigned. Do you think negative perceptions about Baltimore are having an impact on the city's population?
I think it's having a negative impact on how our own neighborhoods see themselves. And that's more dangerous than anything else to me, that our biggest sellers of our neighborhoods, like why you would want to move into any neighborhood in the city of Baltimore, is because of the residents that live there. And so we need to make sure that the residents in all of our neighborhoods who truly love their neighbors and truly love their neighborhoods and are doing things every day to make sure that they improve quality of life are supported and feel empowered that they can bring people into their neighborhood through small things like, hosting a potluck or, inviting people in or putting a sign outside their neighborhood that's very low cost, but, pretty clear that this neighborhood is X. I think we need to make sure that all communities feel like they can do something right now in the face of what may seem like really you know, bad news, that they can do things right now to make sure that they improve the quality of life in their neighborhood.
People blame Baltimore's population decline on crime, on high property taxes, struggling schools. What do you think is the main reason people leave?
Those are all symptoms. We have actually literally done analysis doing correlations on neighborhoods that grew and crime rates, and there is no correlation whatsoever. If you think about it, when you, like I mentioned, when a neighborhood is growing, retailers will come. And where we have retailers, we tend to get incidents of crime. This is the kind of thing that neighborhoods have to deal with, like Federal Hill, Canton, Locust Point. They're going to see rise in incidents of crime because there's things for people to steal. Now, those neighborhoods are trying to deal with it, but they're growing neighborhoods. They're still growing. There's cranes all over the place in these neighborhoods. So crime itself is something that we must address in our growing neighborhoods as much as in our declining neighborhoods. They're just different kinds of crimes that we're seeing in both of these kinds of neighborhoods. But they're certainly not stopping people from moving in.
Seema, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Seema Iyer heads the Neighborhood Indicators Alliance at the University of Baltimore's Business School. Quick break now. When we come back, we'll talk with retired Johns Hopkins University sociologist Carl Alexander. He's heading a new venture aimed at keeping families of means in the city. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about recent census estimates indicating Baltimore's population is declining. Again, Carl Alexander has some insights into this, and he joins me now. As a sociologist at Johns Hopkins University, he spent decades researching city schools. In his retirement, he's launched an initiative aimed at improving city schools, thereby keeping middle-class families in the city. Carl Alexander, welcome to On the Record.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Thurgood Marshall Alliance.
So it's a diversity initiative that's paired with school improvement to improve programming and practices so that Marshall Alliance schools will be welcoming places for children and families of all backgrounds with strong educational programming and enrichment opportunities, including after-school and summer programming. But the diversity niche comes into play in the in identifying the set of schools that we want to partner with, and we've got three terrific ones.
Who are those schools?
They're Govins Elementary, Mount Royal Elementary Middle, Midtown, and Federal Hill Prep in South Baltimore. So actually, Seema, who was just on, she was a terrific help to me in that when I started thinking about how we wanted to move forward with this, I consulted with her and we did some mapping exercises because I was interested in identifying neighborhood schools which have geographically bounded attendance zones, and all three of these schools do. Govins is a conversion charter, which means it's charter school, but it also has a attendance zone, a neighborhood attendance zone. And so we wanted to work with neighborhood schools that are located in parts of Baltimore City where the surrounding communities, that is the families that are entitled to attend these schools, are much more diverse than is the case at present in the schools themselves. This is the case in many neighborhoods throughout the city. You have lower income communities in close proximity to the middle class communities. You have communities of color in close proximity, predominantly white communities. And these neighborhoods exist substantially in, are segregated, that is, in separation from one another. Baltimore, last statistics I saw, was the seventh most segregated city in the nation. But there is a place where these communities can come together, and that's by sending their children to their local neighborhood school. So the goal of the Marshall Alliance is to partner with schools that are situated like that and to work with other stakeholders and the school leadership and the PTOs and anyone who's invested in school improvement and neighborhood improvement in helping to make these schools the kind of place that anybody would be happy to have their child attend. And so we're looking for opportunities to be helpful.
Helpful in what way? What can you do?
Well, the end game is to attract more families who live in zone into their neighborhood school, including especially families of means who have options. As a rule, cities do not shrink gracefully, and that's certainly been the case with Baltimore. It's also true that school systems don't shrink gracefully. The Baltimore City Public School enrollment peaked in the early 1970s at almost 200,000. By last count, there were a little over 80,000 children rattling around in a physical plant that was designed to accommodate an enrollment 2.5 times as large. So there are a whole host of issues that presents, fiscal issues, efficiency issues. But our focus in our niche is equity and diversity. The guiding principle that motivates what I'm trying to do is that we are a healthier community when families of different background and children of different background come together in common purpose. And our neighborhood schools used to be that place, and I'd like to think could be that place again.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with sociologist Carl Alexander, director of the Thurgood Marshall Alliance. It's an initiative aimed at increasing diversity in city schools. How big a factor do you think schools are in the city's population decline?
There's the perception and the reality. You know, the perception is that the city schools are just horrible, dysfunctional, nothing good is happening in them, and that's absolutely not the case. But it's a tough nut to crack when you have a media that is chronically negative in its coverage of the city schools. And bad things are happening. It's not just made up. But there are a lot of good things happening in the city schools, and there are a lot of people out and about in our three schools and in the community surrounding them that really do want to be part of the city's revitalization. They value a strong sense of community, the kind of an urban vibe, and they want to be supportive of their local neighborhood school, but they're not going to do that if they're concerned they're going to consign their child to a second-class education or worse than second class. So what we're trying to do is to make the case that there are a lot of good things happening in these schools, and better things will follow. If you're interested in staying in the city, come in and check out your neighborhood school and see if it could work for you. Don't just decide you have to move out to the county because somehow, some way, you're of the opinion that there's not a decent school that's available to you. The Baltimore Education Research Curriculum did a very telling analysis of population flows a couple years back. They tracked all the children born in Baltimore City and then looked 5 years later how many of them were enrolled in Baltimore City Public School kindergartens, and it was only about half. So the city system is hemorrhaging, and the city is hemorrhaging young families. And it would be transformative if we could encourage more of those families to do what they want to do. I mean, as a target population, they're already in the city. They obviously like the idea of city living. And yet, for whatever reason, there are a lot of reasons, they are of the opinion that they just can't stay the course, and we want them to feel more comfortable staying the course.
You've conducted focus groups about schools with young families in the city. What do they most want to see in a school?
So it's interesting you mentioned that. We did conduct focus groups with parents who have children in these three schools, but also parents of preschool-age children living in zone, toddlers and infants. We call those pipeline parents. And the things we heard are very similar. I mean, they do have concerns about resources, right? Most of those trace to North Avenue and are beyond the control of the principal and the school leadership. That makes them unhappy, and understandably so. So there are resource constraints. Many of these schools lack the amenities that they could find if they took their child to an independent school or moved out to the county. Those are realities. But we also heard that these schools have competitive advantages. People like the idea of supporting their neighborhood school and being able to walk to school. And all of these schools have a committed core. They're diverse. All three of them are diverse. The demographics are different one school to the other, but all three of them have a committed core of families of means who've made a commitment to staying with the city schools, to supporting their schools. And I'm convinced through our focus groups that that's potentially the tip of a very, very big iceberg. You're not going to be able to win over every young family, but it doesn't take every young family. I mean, attracting a critical mass of family means back into the city would be beneficial for everybody. Their children will be better off because they learn to be comfortable with children who are of a different background from themselves. Those families will help elevate the academics. We know this from research literature. Those families are more effective advocates for their children. Family of means speak with a common voice. School leadership and the North Avenue administration will listen. You know, they can be a very powerful agent for school improvement and school change. And there's also a very simple formula. I mean, it's per pupil investments in our schools from all sources, federal, state, and city, are roughly $15,000 per pupil. And between $5,000 and $6,000 of that stays with the school. So if the Marshall Alliance, and this is where I hope that we'll be able to make a meaningful difference, if we could encourage 10 families to send their children to their local neighborhood school who would not have done so otherwise. That's an additional $15,000 in the school budget. The principal could do some wonderful things with that. But let's play that out. If in the second year we get another 10 families, that's 20 new families. And that's $100,000. And so now we're talking about the kind of money that could really make a significant difference in terms of the resource shortfall that we all worry about.
Good luck. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carl Alexander is a retired Johns Hopkins sociologist and the director of the Thurgood Marshall Alliance. At the top of the show, we heard from University of Baltimore professor Seema Iyer, who heads the Baltimore Neighborhoods Indicators Alliance. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, links to both groups. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Tune in tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.